Hello and welcome to
2 o'clock with Kella.
Bring your tea
and leave with more.
Welcome back to a brand new series of 2 o'clock with Kella.
Welcome. I'm feeling really emotional now. I feel a little funny because, as we just said before you click record, it's been so long.
It has been so long, and a lot has happened since we last recorded. I mean, Kerry, you finished your master's degree.
Yeah, and I finished my
bachelor's degree.
Yeah. Oh my god, I just got goosebumps. It's crazy. We finished education. What?
Absolutely mad.
We've seen Harry Styles together.
We have seen Harry Styles together. Oh
yeah, which is more important. No, it's not. But
what a night! What a night!
Yeah, I know. It's all happening.
It's all happening, and also, we're recording an episode about something which we have spoken about before, but we haven't spoken about this performance of it together in much depth.
Uh-huh. I honestly don't remember.
Do you know?
I was like, have I spoken to you about it? I don't know.
I think we only briefly did. Mind you, we both saw it back in, what, April
time? Yeah. I know, I think I said to you when we went up to Edinburgh, I was like, wait, when did you see it? Have you seen it yet? And you were going and then it ended, but we hadn't messaged. So yeah, it's been a crazy time for us. We haven't recorded in ages because we were like, we need to do our dissertation.
Yeah, it's been a crazy few months.
Yeah, and obviously this is all about fun, so we weren't going to cram it in. But I was so excited to be back. This season is going to be our best yet.
We've got some really fun stuff lined up.
Yeah.
So. Keep tuning in every other Saturday.
Mm-hmm. And we've got some fun new features in that. We're trying to
pass it up a little bit.
Yeah, I love it. I feel a bit self-conscious now talking on here because it's been so long. And also because I was saying to George recently, we walked past these people and they had really posh accents, they were about our age. And I said something like, oh, I don't sound like that, do I, as a joke? And she said, actually, yeah, Kira and I have been saying recently, since you've moved back home after uni, that you now keep saying like, yah, and sounding really posh. So no, I just don't want to talk because I don't like
it. Oh no.
Yeah, she said, oh, you sound really Oxford. I was like, I didn't even think Oxford has an accent. Yeah. I don't know.
I guess it's not as distinct as other places.
Yeah, really. I just thought it sounds like general South. It's not Chelsea, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I just wanted to say that. Like, yeah. Please don't come at me for being raw. Because that's not me. It's not my vibe. Yeah.
Oh, but anyway, shall we just jump straight into it?
Yeah.
Funny little hand movements as we jump in. Maybe one day we'll like video record one of these and post that alongside the audio, because we can do that.
So we can. Ooh. Potentially 100. See, the 100th episode is this series.
Yes, and we're going to have some guests with us on that episode. They don't know it yet, but they're going to join us.
They're going to be here.
And
bigger and better, everything. This episode, not this episode, this whole series.
This whole series is going to be great. There's lots of really fun stuff.
Yeah.
New takes and old classics and just new takes.
On Thanks for sticking with us if you've listened to any episodes from our previous series. Yeah. If you haven't, we should probably tell you that we talk about all things books, films, TV shows, theatre productions.
Yep.
All
media forms.
Yeah, like pop culture stuff from perspective of English students. Take quite a feminist perspective on a lot of things. Yeah, that's about it. Yeah.
We just have a nice little chin wag and hope that you enjoy, and follow us on Instagram, 2 o'clock with Kella. And we also have a blog as well, which is linked in the Instagram, which we will post little bits about, like developing on some of the things we've been consuming recently or some of the topics that we discuss on the episodes. So
yeah, or just links to the things we've spoken about.
Yeah, so that's go-to place, and if you have any thoughts, message us.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear what people think.
Yeah. But without further ado, we will now move on to what we've been consuming.
What we've been consuming. And I guess there has been a lot of consuming in general for us both, but we're just going to narrow it down and just give one highlight of what we've been consuming recently.
Yeah.
Hey, Kerry, what have you been consuming this week?
I've opted for this book called The Guest List by Lucy Foley because I have just finished reading/listening to it, literally 10 minutes before we called. And I need to talk to someone about it. I won't give spoilers, but oh my gosh, there's so many twists in it. And I'm sure that a lot of people will recognise the name, or maybe they've read it. But if you haven't, she also wrote The Hunting Party. And is it called The Paris Apartment or something? It was a big, it was a bestseller.
Yeah, that sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah,
I definitely recognise The Hunting Game because that was big, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or maybe it wasn't big and I just saw it.
I know, I think so. But I read it purely because I don't normally like thrillers. Think sometimes I get a bit like, ooh, is that unethical? Which we get into on our episode about The Good Nurse, if you want to check that out. But I wanted to read it because it was available on Libby, which I use all the time now, the best audiobook app for free. And I just thought I'll give it a go because it kind of gave me And Then There Were None vibes.
Ooh.
And it's all about, there's a wedding on an island off the coast of Ireland, which is, that's hard to say. And at the start that someone's dead, but they have dual timelines for little snippets of what's happening in the present, and you're not sure who's dead. And it has maybe 5 different perspectives.
Wow, so that's quite a lot.
I love that it's, you hear from each character about everything going on in their life outside of the wedding, and the wedding is what brings them together. But so it's not really about the murder, it's more just about the people. It's a kind of a character book, but it's super, super interesting. Not quite entertaining because it's a bit harrowing, but I was surprised that it was a thriller that I felt like it just had a lot to say, that had a lot of substance to it whilst being super readable, which everyone knows is my fave thing. I was like, oh, that was readable.
So
I was really impressed. The best book that I've read this year, I'd say. And I don't even normally like those kind of books.
Wow, that's really interesting. Oh, I'll have to add it to my list.
Yeah, I don't think I even stopped for breath there. That's how excited I am about it.
And I can imagine it's a good book to listen to on audiobook, especially if you have 5 perspectives.
I loved listening to it on audio.
And to hear all the different people, I think, yeah.
Yeah, because it all had different accents too.
That's really, yes, I think that's one that's suited so well to audiobook.
Yeah, because it's kind of like, it's almost an eyewitness account that you're listening to, some kind of trial. Yeah, it's really good. I really recommend the audiobook. You can definitely get it for free on Libby if you live in Oxfordshire.
Yeah. And also, I've found that with the Gloucestershire libraries anyway, you can use BorrowBox, which is essentially the same as Libby.
Oh.
But it's got a whole load of ebooks and audiobooks that you can borrow for free.
Oh, that's so really good.
Try Libby or BorrowBox.
Yeah.
With your library account and
do it. Yeah.
Hey Ella, what have you been consuming this week?
I was trying to think, and I've decided to go for an album, but it's a deluxe version of an album that I think I've maybe spoken about before, but whatever. Basically, it's Noah Kahan's Stick Season album, but the deluxe version, which has 6 new songs on it.
Oh, treat.
It's basically, it's strange because it's not really a summer album. It's definitely like a autumn. It's like a sad girl summer album.
Mm-hmm.
About, he writes all these semi-autobiographical, but not really, songs about, because he's from a small town in America. So they're about small towns and kind of growing up and leaving your small towns or coming back or whatever. And I just really love his music. And he's coming to the UK on tour at the end of the year. So I'm going to attempt to get tickets and maybe see him and just be standing in an arena somewhere crying as I listen to his songs. But yeah, I love it a lot. It's very good.
That's just made me think, have you got tickets to see Hozier?
Not yet, but they're only £50 for Birmingham, so I think I'm going to see if other George from Cornwall wants to go with him. She's a fan. So yeah, so it's going to be a sad girl year. Hozier with his new album coming out soon, you'll get an earful of that in the middle of August, don't you worry. But for now, Noah Kahan, Stick Season. I think this, like, subtitled, We'll All Be Here Forever, which is really cute. There's some angry songs in this, the bonus songs. Some of them he gets quite riled up, and I kind of love an angry song.
Does that suit your mood right now?
Maybe. I think they're quite cathartic.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Angry song. But take from that what you will. But no, there's also some really beautiful, lovely ones. So, big fan of that. So I thought I'd, waffle about that for a minute.
Yeah, well, thanks for sharing. I definitely need to check him out because I've seen you listening to him a lot recently.
Yeah, I'm not sure what you think. I'd be interested to know what you think.
Okay.
Because I think that's a big point where our music taste differs. Is people like Noah Kahan and Hozier and things like that.
Yeah.
The sad things, because you're definitely a fun, upbeat music person.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I'll get back to you on that.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't have to. I'm not forcing you to listen to it.
Okay, thanks.
Anyways, this week, we've been dragging this on, prolonging this, teasing you about this week's episode, even though you know what the episode is because you've seen the title. But we're going to be talking about A Streetcar Named Desire.
Yeah!
Which is a play that I'm sure listeners of the podcast will know that we both love.
Yeah.
Both studied it a couple of times across our education. We both recently saw the production with Paul Mescal in that was on at the beginning, like the first half of this year.
Yeah.
So chatting a little bit about that and just the play in general. Only like a brief overview.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be diving that deep just because we don't have the time to.
No.
But
I will say actually that there is... if you just search Streetcar on Spotify or whatever you listen to your podcast on, then there are a number of few good episodes by people that go more in depth. I listened to one and I can't remember who it was by, but I mentioned it on another episode. But I'm sure loads of good ones will come up. Yeah. So if you still need more Streetcar fix after, then do that. But if you're here for Paul Mescal content, go no further.
Yeah, no. And I haven't... I'm gonna open with this. I was chatting to Tilly earlier about us recording this and Paul Mescal, and she said, "Oh, I was thinking he's kind of got similar vibes to Niall Horan," and I was like, "Does he?" And I wanted to get your input on this, whether you think there's something similar between the two. Like, are they the same person in different fonts, or are they not?
Do you know what it is? It's now that Paul's hair's longer, he's a bit mulletty, and Niall's let his hair go brunette.
Okay.
But even just their energy is quite similar because they're both laid back.
Yeah, and I wonder whether a lot of that is the Irish thing in them.
Yeah.
But I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
No.
Because I wasn't sure, because I'm not as big of a... Niall Horan fan of you.
I actually really see that. Hmm. Yeah. That's a strong opener. Love that observation from you. We all, though, do do a quick summary before we properly get into it. Very brief, because I'm sure most people listening to this will have seen it or read it or whatever. But
and it's one of those that everyone seems to know.
Yeah.
But go on.
Okay.
Let's summarise.
So it's about Blanche Dubois, and she goes to visit her sister Stella for Star, and her husband Stanley Kowalski in New Orleans. And it's about all the family drama and the other people that live there, and it's quite dilapidated. And but it's fun, you know, they have all the jazz music there too, and Blanche is mentally unstable, which is no excuse for how she gets treated in this. No. But you find out about her trauma, and you work out why she's been lying about a lot of things, and there's so much tension in the house, especially between her and Stanley, and it's mainly about those three and the tensions between them, and it's a lot about appearance versus reality. And we should do trigger warning now.
Yeah.
Trigger for trauma, because
it
ends very sadly, which we will get into, but I think that's all I'll say for now. Yeah. And this production,
I think that's a very good,
good
summary of it.
I was just going to say about this production.
Yes, good idea.
That, well, we've got the programme open in front of us.
Yeah, so we've got the whole casting creatives.
Yeah, the director for this production was Rebecca Frecknell.
Yeah. And I must say, fantastic direction.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
In this, so good.
Yeah.
For a play that takes place in essentially two rooms which are joined by Hilton. Amazing.
Yeah. Blanche was played by Patsy Barron, and Stella was played by Anjana Vassa. Yeah.
Obviously Stanley was played by Paul Mescal.
Yeah.
And then you've also got, Eduardo Ackerman, Alexander Elliott, Gabrielle Garcia, Cash Holland, what a name. And then, Dwayne Walcott is Mitch as well.
Yeah. I was going to say something. Oh, I just wanted to point out that, this is a Paul Mescal fan club, but we loved this before he was invited. We would have seen this anyway, because we love doing it at A level. So.
And I find
that the need to make that.
Yeah, there's something so interesting about going to see a play that you know so well that you could sit there and recite the entire play yourself.
Yeah.
And there's something about that experience of them watching it and seeing, noticing all the tiny little emphases they put on certain words or certain lines or the kind of movements and things like that. I just love picking up on all those tiny details when you know something so well, you're able to see everything. And I think this is one of those plays where it's just a joy to know it and see all those things. Rebecca Frecknell did such a good job at the way
she
did it all, and the acting was superb.
Didn't they got Olivier? Maybe Blanche did.
Yeah, I think she did, and I think he did as well.
Did she?
I'm sure he was an Olivier winner.
Oh, Paul.
Yeah, so they definitely won awards, and very well deserved.
So even four seasons in, I still haven't mastered not interrupting you, and I do apologise. I'm going to blame it on technology and there being a slight lag.
Yeah, that's fine. You go for it.
No, I was wondering whether to start with staging and props.
Yeah.
Because I think that links the text and this specific production quite well. I was mainly thinking about the front cover, which I ripped off of my program to stick on my wall. It's thanks Stella for the visual.
A visual for you and no one else.
Well, if you guys have seen the posters or whatever, the socials, then it's black and it's got a green neon light bulb. And do you know what I love?
So interesting colour choice, actually.
Yeah, I was thinking, so the light bulb, obviously super important symbol in the play, and we'll get into talk about light. But I find it super interesting that they went for green with it. Like this whole black and green, that does not scream streetcar vibes to me, which is why I think it's such an interesting decision. And I was like, oh, is this green, like the classic green envy? And
if so, who's envious of who?
Yeah. And then I was thinking, oh, is it Stanley being envious of Blanche having, well, not having more money than him, but being, you know,
like the class envy.
Yeah. Or is it her being envious of Stella having that life she wants, having a husband still?
Because I think definitely as English students, you see green in symbolism and you initially go to envy, or it makes you think in The Great Gatsby with the green light.
So I was thinking about Gatsby, because that's when you say green light straight away, Gatsby.
Exactly, and that makes you think of that kind of longing and that inability to have what you want, and that's basically what Blanche this whole time, she wants this, she's trying to get this life that she can't, in a way like Gatsby is trying to get his life. So there's those connotations as well.
Yeah, which I think is such a good choice, because I reckon loads of people will be thinking about Gatsby with this.
Yeah.
And how, well, it's about desire, the entire play is in the title. And so, as you say, the green light is longing, which is basically synonymous with desire.
Yeah, exactly. It's
super cool. But also it's a bit sickly and...
Yeah, definitely.
She's not okay.
That kind of unease about it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just like, it's kind of sleazy lighting as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of that kind of sleazy lighting. I think that fits quite well with the setting and this kind of atmosphere and how that affects him with class. Like, it's not the nicest place.
Yeah.
They don't live this kind of fantastic life.
Yeah.
They don't have this perfect marriage. They're not perfect people. So yeah, there's so much just in the choice of using that green light bulb on all the posters, and even the whole theatre outside, it's black, white and green.
Yeah.
With just them in colour, and a lot of the production photos that you can have a look on their website, all the background is always so dark and it's just popping out in the colour.
Yeah. And it's so meta, because the whole point is Blanche doesn't want to be seen and she's manipulating the truth. But then so Stanley, to be fair.
Yeah, they all are, in a way.
Yeah. So, well, and Mitch, him. Name rhymes with another word that I can't say because this isn't an explicit podcast, but, you know, so it makes sense being green, because everything's murky. You don't have that bright light, you know. And do you know what I love is, I'm pretty sure in this production, okay, we saw it a couple of months ago now, but does it start with the light bulb? Like, it's just the stage, bare stage.
And I think it might bulb. You know, yeah, because that light is right in the center of the stage. I think you're right.
And my friend that I saw it with, Finn, shout out Finn, she had never read it, never seen it before. And so she went, what's the light on all the posters? What does that have to do with anything?
Interesting.
And I was like, just you wait. But I think it's the best symbol, because throughout there's so much stuff about with Blanche saying, oh, turn the light down. Or as Mitch points out, she won't go see him unless it's dark. Puts her paper lantern on. She's got the paper lantern song. So much light stuff throughout. But I think the light is such a good image, because it's all, so much of the play is about deception and who's in control of what you can see and what you can know.
Yeah.
So it's the perfect symbol.
Definitely. I was trying to I thought my copy had some alternative titles in, but I'm sure one of the alternative titles that he nearly went for has something to do with has the word light in it.
Oh, interesting. I
So,
couldn't tell you, I didn't remember that. Yeah,
yeah.
no, that's cool.
No, and that's interesting that you had someone who had no prior anything to do with the play you watched it with, because I went to see it with Erin, shout out to Erin, who we studied it at A level together. We both know it inside out. But yeah, interesting.
Yeah, and also I loved, so I had seen another production. I couldn't tell you who did it. It
Yeah, I
was
saw one back in
it
my
was
A
during our
levels.
A level days, actually. It would have been 2017-ish.
Yeah, that's probably thing is though, we might have seen the same
2018.
production because there was a touring
Yeah.
production
Did
during
they
our A
have
levels.
when they had the woman going Flores, Flores para los muertos? Did you have all the petals coming down when it
Yeah,
was
and
A
they had
level?
like a they would climb up onto the top of they had like a
Yeah.
scaffolding-esque type
Yeah. Oh my God, we saw
thing on,
the
yeah.
same one. What? That's
That's
so
mad.
cool. Yeah, even so, I'm comparing with that one. But even in that one, I don't remember there being as much emphasis on them taking the light shade on and
No.
off. I really noticed them do that with this production, properly emphasizing it. And I loved that. I was so here for it because I just keep thinking of Blanche being in the bathroom and she keeps singing that
And the Paper
the
Moon
paper
song.
moon, and like it's only make believe if you believe in me or whatever the
Yeah.
lines are. And incredible. I just really love that it became such a vessel for power with Stanley ripping it off and giving it back to her, and then her putting it back on. It became right the crux of everything that was happening.
Yeah, I love the idea of it as a kind of vessel of power and thus that central. Yeah,
Yeah.
definitely. Like
Yeah.
it.
It was so good. And also, it's super interesting with the light being so important for Blanche with her, well, her wanting to keep things hidden. She didn't want her past to come to light. But
Nice.
also, in terms of age, which I guess is a more literal way of looking at it, and she doesn't want to see her being older, partly vanity, but
Yeah.
really the whole age thing. I think it's like, well, I interpret it as a like her being fragile and like not being able to
To
like,
like withstand that bright light.
yeah, I think
Yeah, I
it's
like that idea of the fragility of her
yeah,
and how
that's
that
why,
links to the light.
yeah, and also making her seem like more frail than Stanley as he's this young strapping guy. And she wants to keep, and also if she isn't aging, then can she be younger and more carefree, and if she wouldn't have as bad implications for her actions in terms of it wouldn't have been as bad with her getting with the people in the army base or that schoolboy. She's like
Yeah.
trying to, I feel as though she's trying to go back to easier times and not acknowledging her age, not acknowledging the present
Yeah,
in
she's
a way.
definitely trying to stay in that kind of youthful state of her when she was freshly in her marriage, when they were both still young. She's kind of perpetually trapped in that moment of her life and
Yeah.
can't seem to allow herself to move on from that.
Yeah, so
Yeah.
true. And I think this is a good segue into talking. I'm thinking mostly about the physical aspects of the play, and what translates from page to stage. And I was thinking that feeds into the music and how, because you're talking about, being younger, her being happy with her husband, and
Yeah.
the, what is it called? Do they call it like the Viennese polka
Yeah, the polka
waltz
music.
or whatever? Yeah,
Yeah.
that music. And that, again, fascinating how they use it, because when you just read it, you like, you realize it's there, but
And
it's such,
especially in, oh, sorry.
I was just gonna say, it's such a different experience being able to actually hear it, and it's so much more haunting.
Yeah.
And they use it so well because they're able to you know, obviously layer it and make it reach a crescendo. So it's so powerful in this production. They did it so well. I really hope that this gets put somewhere, and so in case you haven't seen it, you can.
Yeah, I really hope they filmed a version of it, because it's so good. And I think another layer of that is the fact that there's essentially a balcony on the stage where you have the musicians sat up there, and there's only a handful of them. You've got them up there the entire time playing this music, so they're so kind of involved with everyone else and everything that's happening. And I think that just adds to that element even more.
And because the music is a motif for, well, it symbolizes the night when her husband dies.
Yeah.
So I think that, I really felt it, and I thought that they used it so well in this production, because they also showed kind of what happened. Do you know what I mean? Like, they acted it out, whereas you wouldn't normally get that.
Yeah.
And so the music made even more sense. And I think it's so important for showing how, because when Blanche starts out living with Stella, you know that she's not okay, but maybe she doesn't seem as bad because you don't know yet about all her lies. You haven't unpacked everything.
Yeah.
But then the music, you notice it come up more and more throughout, and it's very indicative of her every time when she seems to be reaching breaking point.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so harrowing when you realise what actually the music represents and what happened that night. And I find it super interesting in that that music clashes so much with the strong jazz of New Orleans, which I think is very emblematic of Stanley and that strong masculinity, right? Whereas, well, also, you know, it shows, what's the best way to put it? Like, that jazz is the, you know, New Orleans is this melting pot, it's multicultural, you know, I'm mumbling it, but you know what I'm getting at. Whereas this folk music, it's like ethereal, it becomes like, it doesn't feel hot, it feels cold. I'm being so not eloquent right now, but in, you know, it's effeminate. It makes you think of,
yeah,
I can't remember the name of Blanche's husband.
Alan Gray.
And so, you know, it aligns with him, so it also takes on a camper, you know, like feeling.
And yeah, so that, like, idea of the two different types of music kind of clashing, and her, when her music gets to its like peak and its kind of breaking point, and then you don't hear it again.
Yeah, because
I think there's actually quite a bit of no music before kind of more of the jazzy stuff.
Because they definitely play really loud jazz music in the awful scene where Stanley, I've already triggered one, so but when he rapes Blanche, they definitely have that really loud jazz music. And I think that his music was playing beforehand at another point when her music was playing, and they were fighting to be heard. Is definitely, there was a lot of overlapping with the music.
It's almost a meta narrative in the music.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Representing the two of them and how their storylines come inside, and how they butt heads and all the differences in every way. With a play like this, which the music plays such a massive part, that you get some of that when you're reading it, but when you see it and you can hear it at the same time as the action, it just levels it up tenfold.
Because the meta narrative is so important in that you wouldn't know otherwise about, well, okay, so for instance, when Stanley rapes Blanche, he says something like, drop the bottle top, what's he say, like, drop the bottle, tiger, drop it, we've had this date with each other since the beginning. That's it. And then the next thing you know, Stella's back with the baby.
Yeah.
And she's like, I don't know whether to believe Blanche. So, it, you know, it's implied. And the same with they don't really say about how Alan died. Well, they do, but you could blink and you'd miss it, finding out that he's gay and that she was gonna spill the beans.
It's so coded as well.
But it's, it is. And so that's why the music is so important, because without that you just don't really realise, but you understand the impact much more, because it's sickening. It's like, hello, look at this happening.
Yeah, it's like highlighting
those, for sure,
those moments, which if you were to just read it on the page, maybe it'd be a bit more kind of, I think it would be a bit more kind of uncertain as to what happens, but those are two of the big turning points in the plot, because that's when you, with Alan, you figure out part of the reason why Blanche is the way she is and why she's haunted in the way she is.
Yeah.
And then Stella and Blanche, that sets up the ending as well, and Blanche's fate, essentially.
Yeah,
it's game time.
Anyway, Ella, should we just take a brief pause now? Just give ourselves a little interval, like we're at the theatre, interval and streetcar.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, and now...
it's game time.
Yeah, it's game time, baby. It's our new segment. Yeah.
This week's game is Hot or Not, Glastonbury edition. So we've got a couple of bits, and we're just going to have a quick little discussion on whether these were good moments, bad moments that happened in Glastonbury.
Just break up a bit. Just bring you a bit of pop culture.
Pop culture, what's happening in the world.
Yeah, what's going on?
So our first moment is Rena having a go at Matty, as in Matty from the 1975.
Yeah.
What a moment.
I know. I didn't watch this live, right? I just saw it going around on social.
I just saw it going around as well.
And power move, to be fair. Kind of, well, power. I don't know.
In a way, yeah.
But aren't you? I think
sometimes he deserves people to call him out.
Yeah, I'm going to say, like, not over hot, to be honest.
Yeah.
But I think you do, you, bestie.
I mean, power to women, but there are nicer ways to go about that, so I'm also going to
It's the passive-aggressive. Well, the passive-aggressive.
Passive-aggressive, though, is it?
Well, no, just the aggressive. No, I'm not defending Matty. To be honest, I haven't researched. I don't really know what he said, what's happened.
I think it's something to do with the fact that because of her music is part of his record label, they've got some form of rights over it or whatever.
Yeah, but I don't really know, like, what he's done in terms of, like, what he's said that was racist. I don't want to start a whole online thing, like, I actually need to research. But I am a bit like, why at a festival where we're all vibing did you
like, you don't need those vibes,
the fun.
Number two, Elton John bringing out Stephen Sanchez in the middle of his performance. When it initially happened, at first I was like, I didn't recognize his name, and I was like, I don't know who this guy is. Then he started singing and I knew who he was, and I was like, great. But then also I was like, Elton, why are you doing that? Why are you bringing out some random dude to sing a song that's not yours, when you could have brought out Taron Egerton to sing Standing With You or something? Been an iconic moment.
I was so waiting for Taron to come out, because
he was there. He was there.
He was watching, and he sang with him before at shows. Especially when it's his last UK one, something special. Stephen Sanchez was so random. And can I just say, Stephen was hot. Stephen, I didn't know. I've been sleeping on that. At the moment, I love that song.
Not.
But that was, it was a not. Because, come on, he has such a big catalogue, and he wasn't even singing it with him. That was just really rogue. Why would you do that?
All of the special guests he brought out, I was a bit like, what? I was like, what are you doing? Bring out what people want. Like, where was Kiki D?
Yeah, I didn't like any of the special guests. My mum said that, she's like, where's Kiki? I was like, guess she went to Dodger Stadium, and then that was enough.
Yeah, what was Dua Lipa doing? Why didn't he bring out his husband and his son at the end? What was he doing?
Why did he have Brandon Flowers? He was like, yeah, it was an obvious choice for me. Can I just say, I mean, obviously I know who the killers are, but Heather and I, my mum and I turned the TV on, halfway through Tiny Dancer, and I was like, who is this man?
Robbie
Williams. How do you just feel like you're out on your own? You can have all these super cool people who make more sense. Like, why?
Yeah, so a few rogue decisions there from Elton. But
who was that person that came out with the gospel choir?
I don't know, some American guy. I mean, he was having a great time.
He, yeah, was a vibe.
I don't know who he was. Anyway.
I love this set overall, though.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun.
Yeah, good choice. Although, why is he so obsessed with Sad Songs Say So Much?
I don't know.
Didn't he do that at Dodger Stadium? He did that in Songs Save My Life Tonight. And I just don't get it. I just don't not know why. Anyway.
He seems to really like those ones, I think that's why.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, it's Honky Cat, though. Okay.
Third one. Kate Blanchett coming out and dancing during the Sparks set. I don't even know who Sparks are.
I don't know who they are.
I just remember seeing some videos of Kate Blanchett in a bright yellow suit with some headphones on, doing a little boogie. And I was like, you know what, girl? Go for it.
I actually wish that was me. Yeah. Maybe not for Sparks because I don't know who they are.
They're an American duo, but...
Okay.
That felt like a fun moment.
Yeah.
The internet, so...
Yeah, go on, Kate. Go on. Yeah, fair play. Especially in the yellow suit. Oh.
Yeah. It was a good look. It was a good look.
Yeah.
And our final one before we head back to Streetcar... The infamous double bed that someone brought to put in their tent.
My instinct is hot, but it's got to be not. Oh.
I think it is, because I'm like, that's absolutely ingenious. Bring some flat pack furniture and a new mattress. The pain would be taking it out at the end.
Yeah.
But then again, at Glastonbury, how much sleep are you really going to have?
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. So I think it's hot in terms of, I hate camping, so brilliant.
Yeah.
But you're not going to have a good night's sleep anyway. And it's such a walk.
It's such a walk anywhere, like everywhere.
Yeah. Do they not have, okay, so I've never been to a big festival, but do they not have proper glamping sites anyway with quite nice beds? Could you not like that? Would have been surely, even if expensive, it wouldn't be as expensive as buying the whole bed.
I don't think they have like the glamping like that, but I think they have some of like the celebs or the artists or whatever, they'll have like trailers.
Yeah,
stay in.
My thought was just coming
but
from
the general public.
Oh, you know, you know, in the third Bridget Jones film, when her friend makes her go to Glastonbury.
Yeah.
And then they're sleeping in these super nice yurts. I'm like, what? Where did that come from? I was like, I didn't get that at Reading.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that's an actual thing.
Yeah, all right. It's like, not as bad as I thought.
Mm. Anyway, that was the end of our first Game Time segment. And let's go back to some more Streetcar.
Yeah. One more thought I have about music is that because the music's Viennese, I think.
Yeah, Viennese waltz, I think.
Yeah, so then again, there's that othering as well with Alan.
Yeah.
More music.
Yeah, the othering and othering outside of America, because this is a very American, because Stanley feels very strongly about his American nationality. That whole thing.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, I'm not a Polak. I was born in America. I'm an American.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that despite it being in New Orleans, which is, you know, it's a very multicultural place. Oh my God, is the play racist? Well, I don't know necessarily Tennessee Williams himself. I wouldn't say it's racist. It's more so like showing racism.
Yeah. But then again, it was written in the late 40s.
Yeah, but the xenophobic attitudes towards... Well, to Stanley.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's Harry, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah. Wow. And so it makes you understand, like, there's so many different kinds of hierarchies in this. It's not just the family and or bias. It's not even just the sexes, it's not just husband and wife, but it's also about class as well. And yeah, about like him having Polish origins.
Yeah, and you can see there's that insecurity. Like,
yeah, about education as well.
Yeah.
There's so many different things here, which is why I find Stanley's character so fascinating. I really wish I still had with me. I wrote a really long essay about, well, it probably wasn't that long, but I wrote this essay about masculinity and streetcar, and I always found it super intriguing because whenever we've spoken about toxic masculinity on the podcast before, I always go, Stanley.
Yeah. And I think he's a prime example of that, but also he's a very complex form of it. Mm-hmm. He's not a kind of 2D form of toxic masculinity. He's a very three-dimensional, layered character. And even if you think of all the other men in this play, there are so many different types of, even if you just think of Stanley, Mitch and Alan, they're three very, very different types of masculinity.
Yeah.
So interesting.
It really is.
And even Blanche and Stella and Eunice, they're all quite different figures of femininity as well.
Yeah, 100%. I think sex and sexuality is done really well. It's super interesting in this play. I think it's something that is true of all of Tennessee Williams' plays. Yeah. And I love that while it has to be coded with being the 40s, at the same time, I love analysing it in its post-war context of not only the whole inferiority and needing to assert masculinity because of the xenophobic attitudes, but also with coming back from war, having that crisis of, oh, we've got to be soldiers, super manly, whatever manly is supposed to mean in this context. And then the whole idea of fatherhood coming in.
Exactly.
You know, like that's right at the forefront. And then the aligning, as so often is, of masculinity, or like proper masculinity, this toxic masculinity, with heterosexuality and with like being really physical as well.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously there's so much violence in this. That's pretty much one of the main things it's known for. And then Napoleonic Code, obviously.
The Napoleonic Code.
Opposite of a flex, ever.
Yes.
Yeah, it's imaginary thing about, you know, husbands being able to possess their wives,
wife belongs to the husband and vice versa. And
all this, there's so much about ownership. It's just a power struggle, the entire play, isn't it?
Yeah, in every different aspect of every single person's life.
Yeah, it is. But also about control. As much as it's about these desires and doing what they want, pretty much, or Stanley doing what he wants.
Yeah, it stems from that desire for control.
Yeah, because if you think about it, right, when Blanche she's listing off all these things about Stanley, and she's like, yeah, I was flirting with your husband, Stella, that big, like, pig of a man, or whatever she calls him. Did she call him troglodyte or something like that?
Yeah, animal imagery.
Yeah, oh, constantly, because it's always calling him pig and that.
Yeah.
And then he just listens and then just comes in. Well, and then I think he flirts with Stella or whatever, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting scene, because I think you kind of expect him to come in and be kind of inherently violent at that point and kind of very angry and snap, but he tries to kind of play it in a different way, in a non-physically violent way, but in a physical way, but just a different way. Gosh, that sounded complicated, but not really very clear, but I hope you get what I mean.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, he kind of does something slightly unexpected in that moment to kind of assert his control over his wife and his house, and him being like, this is my space.
Yeah, definitely.
And I can like coerce it in this way and that way.
Yeah.
Using myself.
And also because
sorry.
No. Okay. I'll say one more thing and then you have free reign, because I've been talking
to you. Oh, it's fine.
I just get super excited about streetcar. So this production doesn't have doors. It's very, they can enter from whatever side. How does that work? I don't know. But so it's mainly that one kind of
raised square.
It looks like the cube, actually, because it has the start.
It does.
The borders of it, the edges are in that, the light, strip lighting.
Yeah.
Which also is really cool because it's kind of cordoned off around the cube for when the rain comes down, which we must talk about in a second. Yeah. But yeah. I was just going to say, I was thinking of that scene when he's outside listening. And I really like that because
he's just pacing, isn't he, around the house.
It's so unnerving. Paul Mescal does that really well because it's not as if, like, I think when we saw it before, the other version, like, he might be on the balcony or something, or like out on the steps.
Yeah. And he's just sat down, isn't he?
Yeah, but this one, it's very like he's just kind of pacing around the outside, which again is like it really emphasizes him exerting that control, and like he's prowling, like you see, it seems calculated, you know?
Yes, it's that kind of animalistic calculating.
Yeah, he's literally living up to it.
Yeah. Am I wrong in thinking she does a similar thing at one point? Does she walk around at one point, Blanche? Or is that me just imagining?
Yeah, oh my gosh, she does.
And that kind of mirroring of the two of them. Oh,
that's such a good point. It's when she might be like supposed to be having her one hot bath. Like, yeah. Or it could be
at one point, and she's wandering around, something's happening.
Yeah, or I think she might be, maybe this is another point, but she might be listening to them when Stanley's telling Stella about all the things he found out that happened.
Yeah.
About the tarantula or wherever it was.
Yeah, the flamingo or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah.
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 But no, there is definitely traumatic.
Oh, because, yeah, because also she's walking around singing Paper Moon.
Yes, she is.
While she's getting exposed. And because that's the vulnerable side of her, that song. I love it. Yeah.
See, that's Rebecca Fracknell, she knew what she was doing.
She knew. That's so good.
She knew.
Oh, wait. Quickly before the rain, another thing. Sorry. I'm getting too carried away. I was just thinking, Paul is such an interesting choice for playing Stanley because I'm sure there were so many people they could have chosen, like big names. I mean, obviously he is. But, you know, other big names still, because it's such a well-known, well-loved play.
Yeah.
And yeah, so they went for Paul. And I think, like, we started the podcast with Tilly saying he has Niall Horan vibes. He also doesn't appear even masculine, especially, like, if for the majority of the public who go to see him, they think of him in Normal People.
Yeah.
And Connell as an English student who has been open about his depression, you know, is in touch with his feelings. I hate the way I phrase that, but I
know what you mean.
You get the gist. So I think, like, while we've been talking about masculinity, when essentially talking about this stereotype masculinity, like the toxic masculinity, but so, like, according to that definition, he doesn't appear ultra masculine at all. Yet he is supposed to play this, like, ultra masculine character. Yeah. And so that, like, I love that choice. I love that, and it's so weird because you just didn't expect to see him be so frightening.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why I think that casting is so good.
Mm.
Because the type of character that Stanley is horrific. He's a horrible person.
Mm.
And I think there's so, like, Stanley's quite a charismatic, charming guy in his own way,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, you should, I think, even just thinking to the
Marlon Brando,
the film Marlon Brando, exactly. He's got those same, he's had very similar vibes. They've got the same thing, where it's that kind of conflict in it being like, well, you know, he's a bad guy, but he also seems to, on the surface, encapsulate everything you're meant to want from a masculine figure. But actually, he's this horrible side of it. And I think from people who know him knowing him in those roles that he's played before. It's such a different role to this role, and it's that conflict between what you should feel towards this character, and then you also think that conflict that obviously Stella and Blanche are both having, and how they both feel about him. And I think that just adds to that total ingenious casting. I think you have to have someone who's playing Stanley be an absolute god-looking human being. Like, I'm sorry, but you just, that just, that comes with the territory with Stanley, because I think that's so much of his character, is his physical being and his physical presence and what he looks like and how that jars with his emotional and
that's why Stella desires him, because he looks like that. And other things,
but there's definitely, it's very very interesting. It's very good casting and very good acting helps with that as well. I do, it's always very interesting, this Stanley dude, you know.
And I think it would be such a different play if, like, you didn't fancy Stanley. If it was, because to be honest, until scene 10, well, I guess scene 3 was also, I fancied him so much. But you're supposed to, that's the point. And it's, because it's not a black and white play, it's a black and green play. Oh my God, green light bruises as well. Oh my God, poor Stella. And and it is that thing of, like, because you think, why is Stella still with him? But it's also about, like, her being as much trapped by, like, having to perform her femininity as him having to perform his masculinity.
They're both.
Stay with him and be the mum that she needs somewhere for her to bring her child up, you know?
Exactly. And that is such a, such tension. You kind of have to semi root for them in a way, but then for it all to be torn down the way it is at the end, to be left with that, just kind of that devastation at the end of the play when everything happens, and you're just, it feels even more hard hitting because of that, I think.
Definitely. I've really thought of about another 10 things I wanted to say, because I haven't properly discussed street casting as A-level, which, oh my God, I loved it. I loved talking about it so much. I had the best teacher. But I'm aware of time and of me having spoken way too much. So I said that I wanted to talk about the rain. So cool. I loved how they did
that. So cool. I love when they do things like that on stage.
Yeah. So, okay, so especially when we have the newspaper guy, the guy doing paper round at the Evening Star, and then Blanche asks him to come in so she can kiss him, and he's like, he's 17 or something.
Yeah.
It's not good. And the pouring rain of that, oh, it's so stunning when it's such bare stage as it is. And again, it's giving me, like, all this primal energy in terms of, like, they're all caught in the rain. It feels like you're outside, everyone's just caught off guard,
exactly, and they're just
vulnerable, like, against the wood that is super stark.
Yeah, they're like in, they're trapped in their kind of warm bubble outside, like, outside the rain, which I like how that links to kind of like this primal animalistic as well.
And Stanley gets caught in the rain as well, and it's washing everything away. It's because there's so much cleansing throughout, with Blanche having to keep having her baths.
Yeah.
So I, and also rain, wet, desire.
Yeah, there's definitely something there. I mean,
grief as well, but it's so visual. They did so well with this.
Yeah,
oh,
it does look just like beautiful.
Yeah, and it builds a wall up as well. It keeps
it builds up
that square, the only, even though the arm walls,
the only wall in the entire time. That's the only time they're kind of segregated thing, where they can't just move in and out easily. So it's that kind of entrapment in that moment as well, and you're kind of getting towards the climax at that point as well, so that feeling of entrapment, which, you know, if you've listened to our podcast, you know we love talking about entrapment and small spaces. Everything leads back to that, you know.
Even then, though, the wall of rain is a liquid wall. The borders aren't, well, it's the whole thing with
only
having
borders.
Two rooms in the apartment, and it's having that curtain between is literally no boundaries.
Yeah, and like you say, the water is the same. It kind of creates the illusion of a boundary, but actually it's not really very much of a boundary there. So just thinking of boundaries in that way throughout the entire play.
Yeah.
Think of like the lantern as a boundary between the light and the dark. Doesn't work.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Oh, beautiful. God. Absolutely beautiful staging.
We were thinking of even more things.
I know. Oh, I need to calm down. But I just love it. And when you think of, okay, so say with like Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. That is also pretty much like in one room. Yeah, I think it is. And I've seen a recording of it and read it, and it's just meh. But what I love is like with this, with it being in two rooms, and then like it feels so closed off, but it's not boring. Whereas Cat on the Hot Tin Roof is so boring, in my opinion. And some of his other ones as well, like that. Is it called like the Rose Gypsy or something?
Oh yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, boring. I like Glass Menagerie, to be fair. But my point was just going to be that I love with Streetcar is that we've had so many things to analyse, and that there's so many subplots, kind of thing, subtexts. Yeah. Well, there probably are in the others, but it's not entertaining. And I don't want to say this is entertaining in terms of all of the trauma in it. But I just wanted to say at this point, I mean, everyone at this point probably loves Streetcar, and it's why they're listening to this. But I just really wanted to end with saying, like, maybe go and read Glass Menagerie, but don't recommend other things. But I think this one's endured so much because you actually have likeable characters, and it's relatable in terms of like, and maybe name one's as extreme as Blanche, but it's just like the central, like the love between sisters, and then the desire between husband and wife.
It's got, and those, like, sorts of themes that transcend time.
Yeah, it's so timeless.
And the thing is, though, even this production of it almost feels like it can't be shoehorned into a certain era.
No.
Because what they're wearing doesn't define any of that. Like, it could be at any point in time. It could be set in the 40s. It could be set in the 21st century. It's one of those that kind of lends itself to that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from, there's a few things to do with like wires and faxes, or not faxes, whatever. Yeah. Wires, I think it is.
Like telegrams, whatever they do. But it's true. I feel like in the other ones I've read, it's a lot of standing around talking, which is very reductive. I do apologise. but it is. Same with, like, is she called Laura, the one of the main girls in Glass Menagerie? She doesn't move around the room. She just sits there looking at her glass animals.
I feel like so much goes on in there.
Whereas in this, I love that, like, this, we haven't had the time to talk about them, but it's so fun that we have, Mitch is such a strong character.
Yeah.
And with the poker nights, when there's all four of them, and it's, I love the interaction, the different kinds of masculinity we've talked about, and, you know, how people respond to, you know, like, just the different attitudes to the domestic abuse, and like it all being forgiven, you know.
And you see it with Stephen Eunice as well.
Yeah, that's the thing. I like, there's so many parallels. Yeah.
So it's really, because I feel like we've barely touched on any of the other characters apart from Stanley and Blanche.
But it feels broader in reach, even with things like them having a phone, you hearing Eunice on the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. and or like threatening to call people from the outside in when you know, or like saying, oh, this fire, whatever, this like feels like, yeah, it's not as solely like stuck to that one room. And I mean, I guess because it's so transported, like Blanche coming and going, she comes in on the street kind and she leaves.
They're all coming and going, aren't they? But like you say, there is that kind of threat of the outside coming in or the in going out. Leaving, it's so, so good. I do love it. And it's probably one of those plays that I will continue to go and see stage adaptations of when they make them, because it's just, you just get all those extra new little bits and you see things in slightly different lights and makes you think of them in different ways how you ever did before.
Never done just something about it, but there's just always seems to be another thing you discover with it. I so really good. Really love it.
Absolute top-notch theatre, and I mean a fab production, as we said, and such a popular production that they they did its short 12-week run and then they moved the theatre and put it on for another few months.
So like, then
that's how popular it was. And we got to see it then as well, which was fab.
Yeah, we did say surely they must have cinema release planned.
Because they do a lot of cinema releases for their other plays. So I'm sure that will be coming at some point soon.
Yeah.
Definitely go see it if you haven't, if it, and when it comes out.
Yeah, please do.
If not, catch your next production, wherever it is. I'm sure you'll love it.
Yeah, because we love, the script is so brilliant that surely 90% of productions are going to have to be incredible.
Exactly.
It's quite dark now.
Oh, I know. I'm in the dark now.
Oh, it's doing a Blanche.
Doing Blanche, yeah. Hiding my old age.
Yeah.
And my vulnerabilities. Vulnerabilities, that's not. I don't know. Okay, so now that we've. So now that we've spoken my streetcar as much as we can in the time that we have allotted to us, let's end with our blonde moment.
Blonde moment!
Doo-doo!
I missed our blonde moment.
So our blonde moments now, we're just picking one every week between the two of us. And this week's blonde moment goes is also Glastonbury themed. So
yeah, of course.
Keeping up with pop culture. This week's blonde moment goes to the entirety of Blondie and obviously Debbie Harry, who is the lead singer of Blondie, the infamous American rock band from the 70s, who I don't think I actually realised they were still going.
They're still, what, do you have any music? Well, or were they just still like
performing? Okay. I don't know when they last released albums. They last released an album in 2017, so that's quite impressive.
Yeah.
But they got a Songwriters Hall of Fame nomination this year.
Ooh.
And they were nominated for the Grammy Best Historical Album.
Very cool.
So, I mean, they're still being nominated and winning awards even now.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely incredible. So, yeah, they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2006, and they've sold around 40 million records worldwide.
Wow.
Still active. So, and I mean, there are some good Blondie bops.
I love Pop Glass, because I'm pretty sure they had that on Just Dance.
I think they did, yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what's embarrassing? Is I was today's year, like, literally, I only found out now that Blondie isn't just, I thought Blondie was, like, Ziggy Stardust, but with Debbie Harry.
Okay.
I didn't realise it was, like, an actual band.
Yeah,
I thought she just was Blondie.
Thing is, though, for a long time, I thought that as well. I thought she was Blondie. I didn't realise it was, like, the whole band thing.
Yeah,
they had I mean, she was described as having atomic charisma at Glastonbury this weekend. So,
did we just call it Glastonbury?
Glastonbury is what I said.
We really are raw.
Glastonbury? Glastonbury. So, yeah, that was lots of fun. So, I mean, who better to give our blonde moment to than an entire band who aren't all blonde, yeah. But that's okay.
Yeah.
Whatever. So we'll get behind that.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, Kerry, what are we doing next week or the week after?
I hate you. I was going to ask you.
Okay. Ask me.
Hello. What are we talking about next week then?
Next time we'll be talking about some contemporary fiction. So we're going to talk a little bit about Sally Rooney's short story, Mr. Salary.
Yeah.
And some other contemporary fiction that we've read. So we'll probably talk about The Yellow Kitchen, because I know we've both read that.
Yeah.
Read a little bit about Send Nudes.
Yeah.
And I'll see if we can come up anymore, but we'll just be having a nice general chat about contemporary fiction.
Well, can you tell me a bit about Emma Cline on that episode?
Of course I can tell you a bit about
Emma Cline. Okay.
Yeah,
good plan. Okay, can't wait.
So,
oh my gosh, sorry. And Cleo and Frankenstein.
Yes, we have to talk about Cleopatra and Frankenstein.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a fun, jam-packed literary episode next week.
Yeah.
So join us for that, and we hope you've enjoyed this one. And yeah.
Thanks for listening to 2 o'clock with Keller.
Join us next time for more.